For a lot of us, July 1st was simply the day after June 30th, but July 1st can be a big day for a lot of reasons. It is the first day of the new fiscal year for places that observe the July-June fiscal year, and it is often the first day for new laws passed by state legislatures to take effect. So it was with Oregon's new Housing Choice Act passed by the legislature a year ago. The act changes things around for renters who use the Section 8 housing subsidies to help pay their rent. Let's find out how. We have two guests with us. John Van Landingham is a legal aid attorney and fair housing advocate. John, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Jeff.
And Deborah Imsey is with us as well. She's the executive director at the Metro Multifamily Housing Association. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you.
Can you tell us first a little bit about your organization and what it does?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Our organization has been around since 1990. We're a trade association that supports property managers and owners and helps them be good landlords through various education on fair housing and landlord-tenant training.
Okay, so we have basically both sides represented here. John Van Landingham, you would tell us about the Section 8 program and who's eligible for it?
So the Section 8 program is one of the primary ways that the federal government subsidizes housing for low-income families. It's a program that's run through local housing authorities. Every county in the country has a housing authority. There may be some housing authorities, like in Oregon, that serve more than one county. But each county runs this program, and it's designed to allow an eligible family, typically someone whose income is below 50% of the area median income based on family size for that county. So HUD does an analysis of every county in the country and sets an area median income. Many of the families have to be below 30% of adjusted median income, so or their area median income. So that's pretty low. Again, it's based on family size. Typically, you have to be a family, which is defined by the local housing authority, and in conjunction with HUD, it requires two adults or an adult with a kid, or that you're elderly or disabled to qualify. But most housing authorities have waiting lists in Oregon for getting one of these vouchers. The voucher allows the resident to go out into the community and find a private landlord and rent a home, an apartment or a single-family home, below certain rent levels for that family. And it's designed to allow the family to use its own initiative to find a community that's good for it, that's safe, that's got good schools, that's close to shopping, that's close to employment. The other form of affordable housing that people are familiar with would be what is commonly called either public housing, which is owned by a housing authority, or subsidized housing, in which it could be owned by a private developer or a nonprofit, but the federal government helps to subsidize the building of that project. In those projects, the subsidy is attached to the unit. You leave the unit, you lose it, the subsidy. With a Section 8 voucher, you can take the voucher with you wherever you go within the county.
Okay, and does the money for the housing vouchers come from HUD? Is that a federal money stream?
It does,
okay.
It does.
And what's the largest grant that anybody can get through Section 8?
Well, it varies, again, by the local community and what HUD thinks the rents are. So HUD will set a maximum, and the housing authority, excuse me, with working through HUD criteria, will set a maximum allowable rent. I don't know Ashland well enough to know what the average or typical rents are in Ashland or in Medford. But let's say, I saw an example the other day where in the Portland area where the rent was around $900, the housing authority was going to pay about $800 of that based on the person's income. I guess I should qualify. It's a fairly complicated formula, obviously.
Right.
And it also reflects that under HUD standards, the tenant with the voucher can't typically, so there's lots of qualifiers here,
right,
typically can't pay more than 30% of the tenant's income for rent.
Ah, okay.
So well, if the tenant's income is $1,000, then the tenant could pay $300 towards rent. And if the apartment that the tenant wanted to rent and the landlord agreed to rent to the tenant was below HUD's FMR, let's say $900, and the tenant would pay $300, the housing authority subsidy would be $600.
Okay, that goes cleared up. But, yeah, I can see there are lots of qualifiers in there. So, Deborah Imsey, what were some of the issues that the legislation that became the Housing Choice Act sought to address?
Well, basically, some of the things that this legislation addresses in terms of landlord concerns are it established a mitigation fund that a landlord can access if there's damage to the unit or unpaid rent, and that mitigation fund goes up to $5,000. So that was an important component to the bill. There were a couple of other issues that addressed landlord concerns. One was timely inspections. So as part of a voucher holder, the housing authority does an inspection for the unit, and it was important to the landlords that those inspections be timely. And then another concern for landlords was the issue of some housing authorities require an initial lease length of a year. And so the bill works to address the possibility of having those lease lengths be less than a year.
Jeff, could I supplement what Deborah just said?
Sure.
I mean, she will. She and I have worked about on this stuff together for years. But the issue of an inspection time is significant to landlords because under the HUD rules, the housing authority can't start paying the subsidy until the housing authority inspects and approves the unit. So if there's a delay there, the landlord has to sit with an empty unit not collecting rent. There's no prorating back rent payment there. So that's why landlords are so concerned about inspection times. And in some counties, the inspections have taken a week or 2 weeks, not typically, but and in some counties, that's understandable. If you're in Ontario and the housing authority is far away, that might be understandable. But it's a tougher deal if you're a small landlord with just a couple units. And then on the lease term, the reason why that's important to landlords is because if that first initial term is a one-year term, for example, under Oregon law, landlord can only terminate the tenancy for cause.
All right, so for mistreatment of the property or something like that, some actual cause here.
Yeah.
We're talking to John Van Landingham and Deborah Imsey about the Oregon Housing Choice Act that took effect July 1st. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. What's the major change here, John Van Landingham, though? Is there some change in where Section 8 vouchers can be used?
Well, the major change is that is to an existing Oregon statute that prohibits discrimination in all residential transactions, whether it's a renting an apartment or selling a home or advertising an apartment for rent or a home for sale. So it's an existing statute. It's Oregon Revised Statute 659A.421. It prohibits discrimination based on the typical things that you've all heard before: race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, national origin, marital status, familial status, or source of income. Oregon has had that phrase, source of income, in the statute for a couple decades. But we had another part of the statute that said source of income as a protected class does not include receipt of federal housing assistance or Section 8 vouchers. The change that was made by this bill, HB 2639, which passed in the 2013 legislative session, the change is to remove that exception. So now source of income protection includes Section 8 voucher holders. And to be clear, this does not mean that a landlord has to rent to a Section 8 voucher applicant. It simply means that a landlord can't refuse to rent because the person has a voucher. The landlord can still do the landlord's typical screening, for conduct, for ability to pay rent, and should do all those typical things. It's just that the landlord can't, as a matter of course, say no Section 8. And before the bill passed, that was common. If you went on Craigslist or looked in newspapers, you would see ads for apartments or rental housing that would say no Section 8. So it was a categorical denial of anybody with a Section 8 voucher, regardless of how qualified they might be.
I've been in that relationship as a landlord, and people would say, do you take HUD? And the answer was, well, sure. But so, Deborah Imsey, I mean, it seems, first of all, there are some places that are simply going to be priced out of the market because the Section 8 voucher only goes so high, right?
Absolutely.
And on the other hand, then so what are the protections that landlords sought through this? You talked about the mitigation fund. Was that one of the major things that landlords sought as a response for having the removal of this protected class?
Oh, absolutely. And if you think about it, Jeff, there's really no other situation in which a landlord can have this fund that they can go and get recourse from. So it's a protection for the landlord, but it's also, we hope, an incentive to, you know, encourage landlords to really look at ways to make the Section 8 voucher holder relationship work.
Are there any mechanisms in the law, John Van Landingham, that that penalize landlords who violate this the new provision that says you have to rent to people within, you know, within price and other concerns?
Yes. As I mentioned a minute ago, this is a change to an existing statutory scheme that prohibits discrimination in all residential or all real estate transactions. And that in Oregon, an individual who feels that he or she's been discriminated against in terms of housing can sue a landlord or can file a claim with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, BOLI. BOLI is the state agency that contracts with HUD to enforce fair housing. BOLI can investigate claims and can file an administrative complaint against the landlord and assert damages. I want to make it really clear that that the landlord and tenant advocates on this issue have tried to work very closely to make this work. It, you know, I'm not a landlord, but I worked with a lot of landlords, mm-hmm. And my sense is that they would rather not have this change. But Deborah and others are working really carefully to make it work. And we've been saying, she's been educating landlords all over the state. Other landlord organizations have been trying to do the same. And we've been trying to say to the enforcement agencies, let's be careful in terms of how we apply this. There are some gray areas here. And Deborah described a couple of them, the inspection time and the lease term issue. So if we're going to enforce it, let's look for somebody who's deliberately trying to avoid the law, someone who continues to say no Section 8 in their advertising, or someone who does something that's obviously intended to avoid having to rent Section 8. For example, their normal rents are $1,000, and for the Section 8 applicant, they decide it's $2,000.
Got it. So, Deborah MC, are there places where, John just mentioned that there's some education going on. Is there a place where landlords can go to get questions answered about the new law?
Absolutely. I would encourage them to go to our website, multifamilynw.org, and we have a number of trainings scheduled. We also have, a number of just basic facts that they can get answers to, and they can certainly call us. One thing I would mention that's being prepared right now, there's a statewide stakeholder group that's preparing some, a fact sheet of questions and answers. And in fact, John's working on that as well as some other folks. And we hope to come out and make sure that everybody puts that on their website. I mean, there will be issues where we maybe aren't on the same page, but those will be outlined as well, as John said, so that everybody knows that we're doing our best to communicate with one another.
But in theory, then, John Van Landingham, all rental housing in Oregon is now potentially open for Section 8 vouchers. In theory.
As long as the rents are.
Right. Right.
Yes.
That was where the theory breaks down, yes.
And, the concept, again, when you asked me how are people eligible, the concept of the program was to allow people to take these vouchers and use their own initiative to find housing with a private landlord. And with the sort of ad hominem, all Section 8 is no good position that some landlords were taking, not all of them. A lot of landlords had great relationships with Section 8 tenants. But with that no to Section 8, then it really prevented the program from doing what it was intended. I want to add one other thing quickly. I know we're running out of time. There's also an advisory committee created by the bill. And that committee will include three landlord representatives, three tenant representatives, I'm one of them, and three housing authority representatives. And that group will meet probably monthly to try to work through problems. We don't know what they are necessarily yet, but we know there are going to be some issues that we need to figure out. Finally, we owe this new law, whether you like it or not, to the Speaker of the House, Representative Kotek, Tina Kotek, who wanted this to happen and found the money for the Landlord Guarantee Fund, listened to the landlord's concerns, and tried to find ways to address their obviously legitimate concerns.
All right. I want to thank you both for joining us today. John Van Landingham is a legal aid attorney and a fair housing advocate. Deborah Imsi represents landlords through the Metro Multifamily Housing Association. And Deborah, we'll put that link up you just mentioned to your website on our Facebook page so landlords can find their way to it. Thank you again both for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you.